We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 red and goal! And Vettel is still in the lead and Hamilton. Oh no, Alonso's win Flynn! Other open mental!
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 98 of the F1 show for coverage of the Italian Grand Prix from Monza. I'm Robin Warner.
And I am Jim Lau, and isn't it great to be back at Monza? We had lovely Spa 2 weeks ago, and now we've got Monza, just two great tracks, classic races back-to-back, and another classic, really nice Formula One race.
And another classic, really nice Formula One commentary from the stands from CKW.
Yes, our fearless stands grandstand reporter, Craig the Kilt Wilson, CKW we're going to call him from here on out. Because apparently we do not pronounce his name correctly.
We are agreeing to disagree here.
Fair enough. Because I think there are a few words that we as Americans would say that him as a Scotsman may be also pronouncing incorrectly.
But
that's neither here nor there.
Again,
it's how cool is that, right? We've got people from the stands at various races, and you know, sending us audio and just getting us right there in the action.
And what a bit of audio that was! I mean, how cool was that?
Yeah,
excellent seats, excellent atmosphere. That was really cool.
And you heard somewhere in there the sound of a Force India machine smashing into the side
in the melee, that cacophony sound we were getting
of a Renault and then into a Mercedes, and oh man, it was nuts.
Yeah, I think I heard like a Britney Spears whimper somewhere in the background, just barely. You'd have to like break it down a little bit, but it was in there.
Oh, you can't. Oh, okay. I mean, fair enough. Maybe Rosberg would let out a whimper, but to be clear, it was not his fault at all. There was no, you know, it was Liuzzi just came barreling into these cars, and there's nothing they could have do about it, and probably didn't even know he was coming, because he was just torpedoed into the side of these cars.
Sir, you were getting ahead of yourself.
I am ahead of myself already.
You are, but that's okay. I'm going to bring you back, and I'm going to tell you something.
Yes.
I'm excited, and you are the reason why I'm excited, because you were so forward-thinking, so advanced in your thought process and your strategy for this show.
Clairvoyant, perhaps.
Yes, that you thought to bring us Mellow Yellows, the most glorious drink in all the land.
A lovely caffeinated beverage.
It is Mountain Dew plus awesome. It is...
And made by Coke instead.
Which makes it better. And... as an F1 show exclusive, we are going to bust a cap right here on the show.
Right.
And we're going to enjoy these beverages as we go to ensure that this will be an exciting, energetic, wonderful show to keep pace with an exciting, energetic, wonderful race that is always Monza.
All right. Well, in the spirit of making sure that it's a good show and that we have the energy and performance that we need to.
Oh, my God. Yes. Wait.
Ah, that's good.
That is good
that's
stuff.
That's good podcasting.
Were we not supposed to slurp? I slurped.
No, I didn't slurp. I hate that sound.
Take two?
No.
Oh.
Onward.
Onward, of course.
Now
anyway.
We're good to go. So, starting with even Friday practice.
Well, I didn't actually, you know, it's not even in my notes, but I didn't even think of it. There's this whole kind of cloud of controversy that came out from the whole just Hamilton existing and everything that happened at Spa and whose fault it was and all this kind of stuff. And a second whole controversy that turned into this big ordeal, what Red Bull was doing with its tires and the camber and Pirelli's suggestion and all that kind of stuff. I think we have to close out a couple of things. I got no less than two scathing emails from a friend of mine at work who also enjoys Formula One saying, how could you possibly think that this wasn't Hamilton's fault? He's crazy. And that we've equally gotten on the other side. You know, Hamilton's great. He didn't do anything wrong. Why is everyone getting on Hamilton's case? I mean, it was a big thing.
Yeah. And Hamilton himself, I think, agrees with your colleague in that and says, yeah, actually, I guess it was kind of my fault. And sorry about that. It sort of went screwball.
And what's amazing about that is I looked at it again, And I was like, I didn't really see anything too bad about it.
Well, he has gotten a little bit smarter about dealing with the media, and sometimes you need to
when you lower the bar so much, then you could start creeping on me like, oh, he actually didn't do too bad.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess he'd rather be, what, employed than right or something? I mean, maybe there's some lesson in there. But, yeah, so Hamilton himself has come out and said, okay, yes, after reviewing everything, you know, that was my bad, and sorry about that. And either way, it ended his race. So, I mean, no penalties really, you know, made sense to apply there. So it is what it is.
And clearly there is, regardless of fault, Hamilton certainly seems to be a part of these kind of controversies a lot more often than other drivers. And there's just this kind of sense, I actually read an Autosport article about this, that he's genuinely feels, and you know, possibly is right, that he's the fastest guy in Formula One. So he's desperate to be doing well, even though he's not in the fastest car.
Mm.
And so it just pushes him to always take these risks and, you know, get in the front. And I think, I mean, that lines up reasonably close with what we've seen this year. But what's so brilliant about the McLaren team is we have Jenson Button to show you that that's not necessarily the best way to, you know, make lemonade.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, it's kind of this back and forth of driving styles and of success and luck, if that means anything.
But, do you push it?
Yeah,
How much you push it and how often?
Yeah, because just because something is a racing incident, I mean, of course, racing incidents happen, there's still some. I mean, they don't happen out of nowhere. You know, sometimes could one driver have done something differently or put himself into his car in a different place that would have prevented this incident from happening? Because of course, most laps of the race, except maybe today, you know, all the cars make it around the lap, you know, and most times the standard behavior should be that all the cars make it through safely and are driving and have their space and, you know, all their wheels stay on.
And two cars don't occupy the same space at the same time.
Right. So, you know, it could be avoidable depending on what the risks are. And of course that all, you know, stacks up with what the championship lead is and all, you know, all kinds of different inputs. So yeah, certainly it's not that it's an aggressive, like, you know, Hamilton was doing that to purposefully take another driver out. I don't think anyone is saying it's saying that.
Of course not.
And of course he did pay the penalty himself of being out of the race. So it's not like he went on to then go and win and it was a big controversy. It was just a matter of, you know, yeah, it's an incident, but why do these always happen with you, Hamilton?
Right,
like,
exactly.
why is that, you know, come down? Why do we have to be here so often in the steward's office to go and review these things?
So to the details, I still kind of feel like, you know, I was pretty harsh against Hamilton after Monaco, and I still stand by that. And I was pretty light on Hamilton after Spa, and I still stand by that. I really don't think, you know, the thing with Maldonado was a bit questionable, a bit iffy, was it really the right way to go? You know, that's there, but you know, well, the thing with Kobayashi, I think, is right to call it a racing incident. And, you know, but in the grand scheme of things, I really think this is an opportunity for Hamilton to reflect and say, what am I doing here? What really is the best way for me to become a multiple champion?
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, with the championship thinking, where, of course, Vettel continuously says he's sort of not thinking about where he is in the championship, which, I mean, come on. How can you not, you know, not think about that? I mean, I guess it's easy for him to say because he's got such a, you know, he's got like a four-race lead. He's about to clinch the championship.
But it's wrong. There's no way that he's not thinking about it.
Right. So he can afford to let people by. If it comes down to a battle, he can afford to back off. But he doesn't, you know, I mean, as sort of what we've seen, whereas someone, you know, Lewis, or, I mean, any of the second place guys, really, if they back off, if they sort of don't go for any opening, they don't do, you know, what it takes to become second place and, you know, even have a chance for even first place. I mean, it's really obviously an outside chance with the way Vettel's tied things up. But, you know, then what are they doing? You know, like, you know, we of course saw the Senna movie a little while ago, and it was this, you know, a famous line from Ayrton Senna saying, you know, if you don't go for that gap, if you don't push that extra little bit, then you're not a racing driver. You
right.
know, that's the whole point. You're just driving in that case. And
which would be really interesting if that footage exists to hear Alan Prost's response to that, because of course there's more than one way to skin a cat if skinning a cat's your deal. And, you know,
you can win championships and you can be smart.
That is the Senna way, right? And that we're starting to see more and more is the Hamilton way. But given the circumstances, given the talent, given everything that's turned into this, circus of Formula One, is that the best way? So, and we can talk about that a little bit more in Monza race results as well. But the other thing that really kind of came out after Spa was this whole Pirelli's concern about Red Bull's tires, the recommended camber angle that they gave to all the teams, and who followed them, who didn't, you know, the blisters on the inside, the whole deal.
Yeah, this is one of those technical stories that comes up that, you know, gives insight into F1 that a lot of people don't really have, you know, that I hadn't really thought about. FIA mandated camber angles and things like that.
And they weren't,
right.
They were Pirelli recommended camber angles.
And of course it makes sense if you sort of think about it that they make the tires, and of course they've got their testing and their all the you know math and all the knowledge that goes into developing the tire compound, that they would maybe have a recommended camber setting, but it's
And we can say real quick, just from our base engineering knowledge, that it fundamentally makes sense that if a tire has a steeper camber angle, it's going to put more stress on a certain part of the tire. And Pirelli is going to know better than anybody else how much stress a tire can take where, giving temperature, giving loads, and everything else.
Yeah, but it's not like when, you know, you go in most any other race series. I mean, of course, these tires are more specialized than probably any other tires in the world. But, you know, in most cases, you buy a tire and it doesn't come with a checklist of, okay, if this is your car, this is the circuit you're on, this is what you should do. It's sort of like, isn't that part of what the engineering of the teams is supposed to know and do and set up? And maybe they have cars with suspensions that move a little bit differently, or maybe there's, you know, it's an interesting insight, I guess, to see that, Pirelli comes through with these recommendations.
And I think that to answer your question is that most times, and certainly this is the case in street cars where it's nowhere near, most times in most applications, the limit of the tire in terms of camber angle is well beyond the limit of all the other aspects of engineering of what you'd want to do anyway. But given the way that Pirelli constructed this tire and the fairly extreme angle that Red Bull was going for to make their cars work around Spa, it became questionable. And turns out, we found out that Adrian Newey was on pins and needles the entire Spa race because he was effectively the one that made the decision to run the cars with this extreme camber angle, with this known tire issue, and more specifically, with tires they qualified on that were known to be compromised because Pirelli themselves inspected it and said so. So, and Spa is a quick place. So if a tire pops in a bad place, it could be a really bad situation, regardless of how safe they made the cars. There's only so much energy you can dissipate in a certain amount of time.
And with the elevation changes and all that, there's, you know, ups and overs and all kinds of potential ways things could go terribly wrong. All the loads going on, you know, through Eau Rouge and all the you know, famous or infamous, Spa corners. And, you know, which does remind me of the last major tire controversy in F1, which, of course, would be the 2005 U.S. Grand Prix.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was, you know, Ralf Schumacher in the Toyota at the time, on Michelin tires, coming out of turn 9 onto the banking of the actual, you know, the oval main course at Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, turn 1 of the Indy 500 oval.
If you were going backwards.
Turn 11 of the Grand Prix course.
Okay. Anyway, coming out of there, and Toyota was running really low tire pressures, it was revealed. But, ended up, you know, the car broke loose on him. He went around and had what I remember as a 65G impact.
Yeah.
Straight, you know, rear end of the car crashing into the wall. And all the investigation, everything that went on, then there were people talking about we should put a chicane in the circuit. And they said, there's no way we can't change the circuit. It's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And the end result, of course, being that, Michelin said, well, we, you know, don't run our, you know, if you use Michelin tires, don't drive, don't take part in the race.
Right.
And of course, everyone did that. They did the starting lap, and they all peeled off into the pits, and it was a whole stupid situation.
Schmazel is as good a word as any
right.
for that.
Right. And so that was, you know, the tire companies, and I don't know where that came down with Michelin saying, well, these aren't fit to race, and the FIA says, well, if Michelin says they're not fit, then we agree with them, and you know, you say you're not fit.
And the big difference between that situation and this one was Michelin was not the one tire supplier. They were competing against Bridgestone.
Right, and
there was a championship effectively going on.
Yeah, and it made sense to be on the leading edge all the time, which is partly why F1 went to the single spec tire, so that it wouldn't be something that can be quite as directly linked to a potential safety disaster, I guess is a politically correct way of saying that.
Sure.
You know, because of course there's anything could go wrong on an F1 car that could lead to some sort of problems. But, you know, tires, after they saw what happened, especially with Ralf Schumacher's impact at Indy, it was certainly a big deal. That one, I think, with the tire pressures and stuff, probably wasn't the right call because it, first of all, made for a really disappointing race with six cars in it, although there was almost a crash in turn one.
I don't think Jordan was too displeased with it, to be honest.
Yeah, they get their points, but, you know.
I mean, we're digressing a bit here. The real fundamental question is, and I'm very curious to hear your opinion, we have not talked about this ahead of time, is do you think Red Bull made the right decision? With hindsight being 2020, obviously the cars were safe, but it was close.
Yeah.
Adrian Newey was unwilling to change the camber settings, which Pirelli said was outside of their recommendations, and unwilling to change the tires and have their car start in the back. So he said, no, we're going to run this thing that Pirelli engineers are saying is a risk.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's hard to answer that in the future, of course, because we know that it paid off for them and that, you know, nobody was hurt or you know, crashed into or anything. I mean, I guess I'm still on the side of let them run it, because if it goes wrong for them and their tires go down or the car becomes uncontrollable, that has its own consequences. That it's, you know, it's unlikely that the situation would cause problems for other competitors or you know, spectator safety and things like that.
I wonder if you asked Rosberg that question, gave him that vantage point, if he would entirely agree. Certainly something could happen where Red Bull could take out other cars in the process of failing.
In the process of failing, but that would, you know, if they thought that were going to happen, they wouldn't run it that way, because that would be in the process of failing, which would be worse off than starting from the back or changing your camber settings.
But it was a risk. It was definitely a risk that they knew they were taking.
Yeah, and I think, you know, every driver, every team, every you know, race fan, really, you know, has their, you know, whatever level of risk they're willing to accept, and you know, everyone's going to have the level which they seek. And I guess, you know, so I don't see a problem with Red Bull doing that, because I'm trying to think of a parallel of something that, you know, may fly off the car that sort of wouldn't hurt the Red Bulls at all. You know, saying, oh, yeah, I don't care if this affects other people.
Like if this thing happens to be loose.
Like, oh, my car's smoking a lot. It works fine. People behind me can't see, but I'm okay. Like if it was something that affected other people without affecting them. But if they looked at the numbers, I mean, obviously these are brilliant engineers, and Adrian Newey, I mean, I'm not going to question his, you know, sort of, you know, control or just, you know, knowledge about worth risking.
Right.
So if they thought it was really going to fall apart.
It's I think ultimately it really isn't an intellectual decision. I mean, you know the data, you know the statistics and everything. It largely is an emotional decision.
And I don't question his emotions either.
Okay. So I ultimately agree with you. And again, hindsight's 2020, so we've got – it's a little bit unfair for us to be judging this now. But clearly – I mean, obviously, if something did fail, everyone would have said, obviously, you shouldn't have run the cars, right? But since they didn't, now it becomes an open question. But the thing that makes me uneasy of just giving them the free pass is how uneasy Adrian himself was. I mean, there was an interview of him after the race, and he was – he said his stomach was turning the entire race. He was really concerned that one of those drivers were going to get hurt the entire race. And he said it was such a, you know, huge amount of relief that the race was over and they were okay. That, Adrian's own words, are what kind of like say, wow, I mean, according to them, they were pushing it and they really didn't know that it was going to be okay. It wasn't a matter of statistics and, oh, we're brilliant engineers and we know the risk reward. They weren't sure.
Well, I mean, they say that, and I don't have any reason to question what he's saying, but I feel like between, you know, the cars did come in for pit stops and they pulled tires off the cars. So even if they send the guy back out and they looked at the tires that came off and said, wow, these are really, you know, in our own, just looking at them, or I mean, they have tire temperature and pressure data and things like that to look at as the cars are going. I feel like if it had gotten closer to that edge, where there was something was going to fail or something started going down or whatever, that they would be able to tell the guy, hey, you know, you need to back off. You need to come in. We need to put a different set of tires on, go to harder tires or whatever it would be. Or, hey, back off. We need you to slow down by 2 seconds a lap to be able to, you know, whatever. I feel like it's, you know, with all the data they've got and with pit stops and all that, you know, it's I don't feel like I guess I'm a little bit surprised that Adrian Newey would be that nervous, just like something's immediately going to go wrong that would have no warning based on, you know, the rest of what they've seen. Of course, it would be a disaster for them points-wise. I mean, not really a disaster because they'd still lead everything. But,
yeah.
You know, it would be...
But it would be the one thing that could turn things around.
It would be suboptimal for them to sort of have to call Vettel on the radio and say, you know what, pull over and stop. Your tires aren't safe anymore. But they have that ability. So, you know, I feel like, you know, they went with it. And obviously it worked out for them. So that may, you know, rather than being told... this is how you should treat the situation. Since they treated it how they wanted to themselves, and they, you know, they all know how they felt during the race and what they were scared of and how they, you know, how it went through. You know, they've probably learned very well, you know, with the lessons that they want to. So if the situation comes up in the future, you know, they have some ideas of we can push it, but if, you know, if we're not in a good place to do this, you know, they can, you know, think about the setup, you know, with this experience in mind moving forward.
And it's interesting you say that, because part of the results of all this and the outcry was that maybe the FIA should mandate a maximum camber angle. And ultimately, I don't think that's going to happen. And ultimately, I'm glad, because, you know, I agree with you. It's not, we don't want to regulate this. You want to give the engineers as much flexibility as you can, and there's always going to be a way to make the car unsafe if you want, I suppose. I mean, clearly a loose wheel nut can cause a whole lot of problems really quickly, and that still happens in this modern day of Formula One, right? So it's certainly, I guess I ultimately agree with you, but I think it's a very interesting question of morality and emotion and intellect and how it all comes into play, and how you think about how modern and how uncommon failures have become, that still there's just energy and stresses and things that can happen. It's just fascinating to me that how delicate these systems can really be. You know, it kind of reminds me of Buemi's double, you know, link failure in practice, where they pushed it just a little bit too much and all of a sudden, boom, like explosives
right
on the car. So it in a way, it's kind of a reminder of the delicacy of these cars.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of things about these cars that are unsafe. I mean, you know, what they are fundamentally doing, like you say, is how much energy is being moved around and how much, you know, how fast they're going and all that. So, and then, but if you think about even, you know, KERS, we saw some early KERS problems with the cars being in a state where they could, you know, shock someone or potentially...
dishwashing gloves.
Yeah, and you'd have to jump out of the car because there was like an electrical fire and you can't use normal extinguishers on it. And yet we still have KERS, and people are working not to just, oh, well, we can't do that. It's like, let's make it safer. Let's figure it out. So it's always this kind of gray area of, it's, you know, there's no way you can sort of just make an F1 car a viable F1 car as an interesting to race and worth racing and be completely safe. And yet you don't want to just have it entirely like, well, let them just do whatever they want,
right,
and wheels will fly off and, you know, kill people or whatever.
Right.
But where you draw that middle line is just, I don't think that the FIA, you know, a rulemaking body with all the committees and all the people talking about it and all that is always the right way to come to that middle ground. So, you know, I'm sort of happy for them to release, you know, these are the recommendations. You should follow the recommendations. And that way, at least the teams know, if we want to be safe, this is what's safe. If we want to move it, you know, a quarter of a degree this way, or if we want to go a little bit outside of that pocket, we know that we're outside of that pocket and we have to consciously do that. And then the fact that they were nervous, I'm sure means that they were, you know, Red Bull in this case, were watching those tire temperatures and pressures really closely and watching on the, you know, the onboard cameras and watching, you know, checking those tires really closely when they came back into the pits, which is probably the safest thing to do, is to just really, really be vigilant about keeping an eye on these things.
Sure.
And letting them know if as soon as anything were to go wrong, if it were, to, you know, make steps to fix that. So, you know, it was safe and keep going that way.
Yeah. And I mean, the aftermath of it was, there was another recommendation for Monza. Pretty much all the teams were within it. It wasn't a big deal. And, you know, we saw that the tires held up fine. So it was one of those things where just a rare, just all the little things, you know, because a failure that causes all catastrophes, it's never like, oh, this one thing failed. It's always just a buildup of a bunch of little things, you know, adding up, tolerances stacking up against you that cause an issue. You know, once in this long time, you know, the situation of the tires and the track and the way the one team was running them, blah, blah, blah.
The KERS, the DERS, the GERS, yeah.
Everything.
The whole thing.
All the ERS. So it was very interesting, fascinating to me. And I have to say that not only does Mellow Yellow taste good, it caffeinates you, keeps you, it makes us sound smarter, too. We sounded smart just then. Pat yourself on the back. That's what I'm doing right now.
I would be. I said, I'm busy, yeah, drinking on this Mellow Yellow. This is good stuff, isn't it?
This is good stuff.
You know, you don't see it everywhere, but it's when you come across it, it's always a pleasant treat.
So, Tamanza. I think most of us do know the results, but we have to start a practice. And it's actually just looking at who led P1, who led P2, who led P3. Very fascinating. At the end of P1, Hamilton had the fastest lap, Button was second, and it was the two Red Bulls behind them.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of P2, Vettel was atop, and Hamilton was very close behind. At the end of P3, Vettel and Webber
Red Bull 1-2, yeah.
And Massa was third fastest. So it's
practice times. I mean,
yes,
we know
there's a lot going on, but
yeah, and what we've seen over a lot of weekends, especially last year, would be Red Bull's not so fast in practice, and you think, oh, maybe this is the time somebody else beats Red, and then they come back and qualify, and they just do it. But yeah, I mean, certainly with the Ferrari results and stuff, you're like, oh, these Ferraris, you know, maybe have some pace. You know, Massa even up there, so if Massa's there, then Alonso must just be. And then the speed trap numbers were interesting as well. Of course, with actually the Saubers at the very top of the field, and down very bottom, lowest speed trap number, 24th out of 24 cars, Sebastian Vettel with the Red Bull.
Yeah.
So obviously more downforce going on to his car, and how'd that work out for him in qualifying?
Well, this was the one track where I was holding out. People who listen to my predictions last podcast know this. Red Bull, for all their fundamental downforce increase they have on the car, this is the one place you don't want it. They're going to be behind in Monza. No, not only.
They were slower in the speed trap.
They were slow in the speed trap, but Vettel, not only did he get pole position, he was clear by half a second. Now, we do have to say, and this I found fascinating, actually. So Q1, Q2, Q3, it was all great to watch, but I kind of just want to focus on Q3 for this.
Yeah.
Vettel set a time, like a 22.6 or something like that. Both Hamilton and Button were up on that time as they were doing their final laps in the last 30 seconds of the Q3.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton locked up and screwed up the time and slowed down. Button, after Sector 2, was still ahead of that Red Bull time, the 22.6 time. But then he also stopped. He slowed down during the lap. So they both McLarens aborted their very final laps in Q3 and stuck with the laps they set earlier in the Q3 session,
mm-hmm.
which is the ones that ended up standing. And then Vettel just went around and put a stamp on it and took another 0.4 off his own time, put in a 22.3 or a 22.2, half second clear of Hamilton. It was just incredible.
Yeah, I think Hamilton's mistake was early on in his what would have been his fastest lap, and with no time to do it again, was sort of like, oh well, you know, that's how that happened. Just that lockup. But yeah, Button driving in at the end, was a bit of a surprise in hindsight. Again, of course, you know, when Vettel came through with that lap, it's not like Button would have been up enough to actually be for pole.
Right. So he might have been in second instead of third.
So it didn't matter really. But it was setting up to be a really really exciting battle because we had you know, all the cars on track, nose to tail. You know, a lot of times they get you know, all spread out around the track, and it was set up where Vettel would be the last guy to cross the line. So it'd be one of these where Pole keeps saying, "Oh, Hamilton's got, oh, Button's got, oh, Vettel's got,"
and it just
fizzled out at the end because it's like, "Oh, well, Button pulled in. Oh, well, Hamilton screwed it up. Oh, well,
yeah.
Oh, Vettel stays there and it gets better." It was just like it ended, and
yeah.
Vettel has a dominant pole,
exactly.
Which may have been a little bit less dominant if Hamilton had not, you know, screwed up his lap. I mean, he may have had a little bit more in the bag, but but not, you know, half a second. And,
no.
They said that.
They said that themselves in the interview. Like, well, I don't know. Half a second would come from, but maybe a tenth or two.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was very interesting. And then, you know, Alonso, who it was very clear Massa was sent out to, you know, push some air out of the way for Alonso.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very clear in the time sheets that that was the case as well. You know, first time around in Q3. Massa put in a 23.2, and then Alonso put in a 22.9, and then Massa put in like a 23.1, and he put in a 22.8 or something like that. Neither time was enough to get around the McLarens. And what was interesting is the McLarens were also running a little bit higher downforce than the Ferraris. So it seemed like for whatever reason, the way braking zones and everything worked out, the people that were really going for top speed pushed that envelope too far. And maybe that was a better race setup, but maybe not. You know, It was an interesting gamble.
Yeah, and with DRS too, I mean, that's always what you want, right, is max downforce in the corners and then no downforce on the straights. And with DRS, you do get for a few straightaways, and of course in qualifying, you use it wherever you want, but during the race, for a few straights, you get, you know, reduced downforce, not none, of course, but greatly reduced downforce. So that was another variable to the Monza setup question, mm-hmm. which is sort of how low downforce do you dare run to get, you know, to get this top speed strategy. But then thinking about, okay, well, we can open that wing, so how much downforce do we want for the rest of the lap,
right.
and where are we going to be able to use that, both just for overall pace, but also, you know, defensively or in terms of making passes. So, yeah, you get it did add an interesting variable. But, I mean, the Red Bull setup obviously worked for pace. Not for Weber. I mean, he was down in fifth spot, which is a bit disappointing, considering Vettel, you know, putting his stamp on it like he did.
That was the other thing that was so stark is, you know, Weber qualified fifth with a 22.9, basically a 23 dead, and just this year has been a lot tougher for him, and just simply isn't showing the pace that Vettel is. And if you had, again, we've said this before, if you had two Webers in the car, it'd be a very different championship right now.
Mm-hmm.
So just the quick rundown: Vettel was on pole, Hamilton second, Button third, Alonso fourth, Mark Webber fifth, Massa ended up being sixth with a 23.188. Petrov in the Renault in seventh, Schumacher in the Mercedes in eighth, Nico Rosberg in the other Mercedes in ninth. Schumacher's listening, out-qualified Rosberg.
Yep.
And Mr. Bruno Senna in 10th, who just in the end of Q2, just squeaked out by 6/1000ths of a second, got ahead of 11th spot into the Q3 and just said, park it. The best he was going to do, you know, might be 8th or maybe 7th. So why not just save the tires and not even bother?
Save the tires, save the car. Yeah, don't risk anything. And yeah, he bumped Paul Di Resta out, so Paul Di Resta in the Force India started 11th. But yeah, so it's, you know, good performance from Bruno. Yeah, I think that wraps it for qualifying, right?
Yeah.
All right, so the race. And as you heard from the very opening of the show with our report, local reporter, CKW.
CK Dubs, baby.
Keep calling him a pit reporter, but he wasn't in the pits.
He was not.
Strictly.
For
part of it.
CKW.
Our boy, CKW. As you heard from his lovely commentary, you know, an exciting race start. We had, you know, Hamilton on the outside of Vettel.
Yes, a very aggressive move on Vettel's part to defend first place on Hamilton, ultimately allowing Alonso to scoot by both.
Yeah, it was Vettel being a bit Schumacher-y to try to get over, yeah. You know, just
it was
really aggressive, not focusing on his own start and just getting over there, but really focusing on, let me block the other guy as best I possibly can.
Yeah, put Hamilton in the grass. And this time really, really wasn't Hamilton's fault. Hamilton was doing everything just fine. It was Vettel pushing Hamilton.
Well, it pushed Hamilton over, but then Alonso had come through on the right side, and Alonso was two wheels off on the grass and was able to make it through, though. So it ended up working out okay.
The way the momentum was and everything else, it worked out for Alonso because, you know, Vettel finally started coming back to take the correct line, and it worked out for Alonso, luckily.
Yeah. So, of course, the Ferrari fans went nuts, as we heard. You know, there's only a few things that can drown out 24 F1 cars, but one of those things is all hundreds of thousands or whatever of Ferrari fans.
It is unbelievable. Because you can...
They're a loud bunch, you know.
You never hear it when you're watching the television coverage, ever. You always just hear the cars and stuff like that. But in Monza, you can hear... Even in the television coverage, you can hear the fans drown out the cars. It's unbelievable.
I mean, granted, there's only like 8 people that ever go to the race in Hungary, and in Valencia, there's I think 12. But
right,
you know, it's
right.
But yeah, so it's obviously, you know, that's one of the joys of Monza, right? It's just the, you know, the crowd is so involved in it, and it's so Ferrari, you know, Ferrari loving and so on. So ended up with Alonso leading the race for a few laps.
Yes. What happened was Alonso got around Vettel. Vettel kept second. Hamilton ended up in third. Weber had a great start. He only lost 2 places. Schumacher himself, he had a blistering start. Schumacher went from 8th to 4th at the start of the race in the first lap. Very, very impressive from him. But the real drama ended up towards the back of the race.
Started at the back and drove his way right up to the front, sideways.
Very, very briefly.
So Tony Oliuzzi in the HRT, in one of them, he says was sort of driven off the road by Kovalainen and the Lotus. Looking at the video, it's not
really the case.
Not entirely clear. I mean, I can't, you know, conclusively say one way or the other. But anyway, ends up at the very edge of the track and kind of squirrely. So he's sort of, you know, driving back towards the, you know, towards on the track where there's lots of other cars. Of course, there's this whole lower mid pack that just lots of cars that are like four wide at one point. And then he's sort of making a correction from that, steers back off onto the grass, and then just loses it on the grass. So this is right at the breaking point. I mean, some cars are already slowing down right there.
It was actually just a touch beyond it, and that's ultimately why Liuzzi got the grid penalty. I think he did, and I think he deserved, because there was some wiggling around Kovalainen, but Kovalainen really didn't have anywhere to go. And then there was another wiggle around, I think it was the HRTs, but that's because Liuzzi wasn't yet braking, and everyone else was braking. Both HRTs were coming on the brakes to get onto the chicane. Liuzzi went around the grass instead of braking, then realized he had to brake, braked on the grass.
No, he was already lost by the time. He had already lost control. By the time he gets onto the grass, you know, he was trying to countersteer, but it was just off on the grass, and it's not like he then realized he needs to slow car down.
No, but he initially drove onto the grass instead of hitting the brakes.
I don't think he was really on the grass in that first part. He was off on the edge and then trying to correct it back in. But the end result was he's carrying a whole lot of speed and off on the grass, out of control, going basically a 90-degree slip angle. I mean, perfectly sideways into the whole rest of the field. I mean, everyone else is working their way through this first chicane. It's just, you know, really tight right-hander because it's a chicane.
The traction on grass is quite a bit lower than asphalt when it comes to braking or anything.
Two and a half, three cars wide going through the chicane anyway. So everyone there is just focused on what they're doing. And so Liuzzi's car just barrels directly into the side of Petrov's car.
Right.
That then knocked into Nico Rosberg's car and spun him around. And there was a couple other ancillary people that got wings knocked off and things like that. So, I mean, yeah, the first, you know, we haven't had a big lap one, like, schmozzle quite to this extent in quite some time. But it ended up with four cars out right there with Liuzzi. D'Ambrosio was out from that, and of course Petrov
and Rosberg
being out directly from that. And then Barrichello got turned around there. He had to come back and get a wing. A couple guys had to come back and get wings and possibly tires. Bruno Senna had to come back and get a new front wing. So it was a big bit of drama there to come out and also in the start, Weber had his trademark, you know, Weber start, which means he lost two places at the very beginning. And worked his way back. But, yeah, so as you said, the outcome is that that Liuzzi will have a 5 grid place penalty, which I don't think you can really give to an HRT. Because he qualified 24th. How much of a penalty is a 5 grid spot reduction?
Yes. Well,
if he outqualifies Daniel Ricciardo, which he didn't this time, then he would lose one spot. So it's like,
right?
Okay, you're penalized. You're going to have to start at the back. Oh, no, not the back. I mean, come on.
Well, there's a question for you, and here's an interesting strategy for you. If you're an HRT, I bet you have to. Ooh, I was going to say, why bother qualifying at all? But then you have the 107% rule.
Yeah.
That's why. Because I was going to say that's a potential advantage to just say, okay, I won't run at all.
I got all kinds of tires.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Maybe you can pip a Lotus or something because you have a lot more tire, but then you wouldn't be allowed to race. So that won't work either.
Yeah.
Would it?
So it is a penalty, but it's sort of in name only, I think, with those particular cars. But anyway, so it goes. So obviously a disappointing day, especially, I mean, Petrov was, you know, solid.
Petrov performance. Qualified 7th. Both Renaults were looking decent, and Rosberg also. Rosberg qualified 9th. He qualified behind Schumacher, but he was the only one in the top 10 there, I think, that was on the medium tire instead of the soft tire. Rosberg had a different strategy in terms of, like, that first round of pit stops. He was going to be able to go a lot longer than anybody else because he was going to be on the harder tire that when it would last longer. And if he could keep pace relatively, keep in the draft and keep pace with folks, it could have been a good advantage for him. Obviously, it didn't pan out.
Yeah. So we did have some really sweet battles, though. I mean, the first, 10 laps, I mean, even the first 3 laps, we had Vettel Alonso, for the lead.
That was, very early on, we ended up getting the safety car because of this first chicane issue. So after the safety car came out, came a tremendous battle between Vettel and Alonso, which lasted a few laps, and ended with Vettel's coming out of the first chicane outside pass around, I forget the name of the bend, but just that was a beautiful pass on Vettel's part. Mm-hmm. And Alonso pushed him as hard as he could. Vettel was in the grass for a moment while he was turning, but still made the pass stick. That was a pass that Vettel can point out. If people say, oh, he's fast, but he's not a very good passer or something, I've said myself, that was an awesome pass.
Yeah, and that's what Alonso was sort of hoping for, was, okay, if Vettel is thinking like a champion, and of course Alonso knows how that can be, you know, working for a second world championship and whatever.
For a third.
Well, Alonso would be working for his third, but he knows what the situation Vettel is in, because Vettel is working for his Vettel's second.
Okay. Now I'm with you. Same page.
Have another bit of mellow yellow.
Same page. There you are. I got it.
Then he's figuring, oh, you know, he's not going to want to, you know, stick in this with me. He's going to back off and let me go through because, of course, he's, you know, Vettel still got his championship lead and blah, blah, blah.
Excellent suggestion, by the way. I had more mellow yellow. That was fantastic.
There you are. And I know, I mean, you know, and Vettel was worth it to stick in that pass and worth it to make it happen. And once he got past, he just checked out.
Oh, unbelievable.
And at Monza,
the place where Red Bulls are supposed to be weak, he was gone. No one could challenge him.
And I guarantee you there were all kinds of prayers working toward Alonso. You know, as much as any human can will another human to do something through telekinesis or whatever,
right,
was being sent Alonso's way.
Right.
Not so much
right.
Massa, Alonso.
Right.
Just to be real. And to say it, Vettel then was nowhere except first place the rest of the race and went on to victory. We didn't even see him the rest of the race.
Dominant, absolutely incredible victory. He will be world champion. I mean, it's going to take the kind of axe, and because we're talking about mathematical possibilities only mm-hmm. at this point. So I think he has the opportunity to clinch it in Singapore.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, this race, I think, was a championship-deserving race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Spa was also fantastic, but he really earned it. And just Red Bull as a team really just shut all critics up, I think. It's just absolutely incredible victory. But to me, that wasn't the highlight. Michael Schumacher was awesome to watch.
Yeah, so
especially early on.
Yeah, in the first, like you said, I mean, he qualified, what, eighth, was it, and then got up to fourth just in that first turn, basically, you know, good start.
Unreal.
And kind of, you know, working his way through the craziness of the field, and he was luckily just in front of the whole Liuzzi torpedo situation.
I'm going to pick me up some Centrum Silver is what I'm going to do. That is some effective stuff.
And so then he found himself behind Hamilton for a couple laps with the safety car and all that. Once that was out of the way, Hamilton said he kind of lost the focus on the restart or something. You know, Hamilton has done some restart trickery in the past and, you know, used that to his advantage pretty well. Not today.
No.
He was asleep at the wheel, I think, in his own words. And Schumacher got around him there on, like, lap five and stayed in front for a good long time. Hamilton was trying. And we make fun of the F1 commentators for calling out any one particular driver or another as this guy's really good at passing or this guy's really tough to pass.
Right, yep.
Because, of course, you could say that oh, Alonso is one of the best, or Alonso, Hamilton's one of the best passers in Formula. Oh, but Schumacher's one of the best defenders. I mean,
yeah.
You could say that the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, but what if it rains? One of them's amazing in the, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Right.
They're both brilliant drivers.
They're both world champions.
Right. And I think I should notice, you know, places one through five was Vettel, Hamilton, Button, Alonso, and Schumacher, and it's like all world champions, most of them multi-world champions. I mean,
right.
It's pretty kind of wild the way it works out, I guess, when, you know, Weber and Massa get out of there and Rosberg and these guys. But so, yeah, I mean, very good racing to see. You know, I think with even with DRS, which was, you know, it seems like McLaren with the wing open still was more downforce than Ferrari, like with the wing closed. I mean, the Mercedes, I'm thinking of Schumacher again.
I know what you're saying. Yep.
Yikes. Too much mellow yellow. Maybe went a little bit too far on that.
And, slow down.
Oh boy.
Shrink the sips.
Yeah, I must. So yeah, the DRS didn't seem to be terribly effective.
And also, Schumacher was making his car wide. He was placing it. He was very aggressive with defending, but in my opinion, was on the right side of that aggressiveness. He never really broke the rules. He got very, very, very close, but he didn't break them. And the stewards agreed with us. And he placed his car to make it very hard for Hamilton to get around. He had to get around the hard way every time, and he just held Hamilton off brilliantly. But that's not even my favorite part. My favorite part is Button had a little bit of a sloppy start himself. and he was playing catch up. So their Button is in fifth place behind Hamilton and Schumacher. It's like, well, there's no way Button's going to get around. And Button, almost immediately after he catches up to Hamilton and Schumacher, gets a better exit off the first chicane than Hamilton, shoots right by him on the inside, and carries some momentum right by the outside of Schumacher, passes Schumacher on the first try, and is off to third, starting to catch Alonso. And then Hamilton and Schumacher continue to fight each other. Incredible to me.
Yeah, it's for as much as you want to say about Hamilton's aggressive and passing and, you know, really crazy driving style against Button, sort of, oh, reserve, you know, save the tires, blah, blah, blah. I was concerned maybe they'd gotten in the wrong cars by accident. We're like, oh, is that Button? Is that, you know, yeah. Like, let's look at these guys closely. You know, they switch helmets or something. But, yeah, it was, I mean, props to Button for a very successful just bit of driving, really. I mean, it was very planning, you know, it was, of course, the two drivers, you know, with Schumacher and Hamilton just fighting each other. Of course, that's going to slow down their overall pace a little bit because they're checking mirrors and they're putting the cars in not ideal situations for lap time, but ideal situations for blocking. And yeah, Button had the ability and advantage to be able to see from behind that what's going on, plan the attack and make it work. And yeah, that was some, you know, a classic Button, I should say, for a... that should make any Button fan happy.
I was quite happy as a Button fan. And I guess to kind of, as we're doing, to kind of close it out, Button ended up having some great battles with Alonso, you know, before and after first and second pit stops. At the end of the day, Button was able to best Alonso and end up second, finishing second in the race about 10 seconds behind Vettel. And Alonso was able to steer clear of this whole Hamilton v. Schumacher thing and did get a Ferrari on the podium to finish third.
But, and boy, did the fans like that.
Yes. And, you know, Hamilton did eventually make his way around Schumacher. And
well, after Schumacher got a stern talking to from Ross Brawn.
which was funny.
Yeah, so we got, you know, radio message from Ross Brawn, of course, who we haven't heard on the radio in years. And comes up and says, you know, leave plenty of room at the chicane. Like, just... you know, okay, whatever.
Don't get accused of blocking.
Yeah, basically was his message. And then, you know, a couple laps went by. Says Schumacher, like, Michael, really leave room at the chicane. Like, you know, don't make me come out there. And, you know, like, when you come, you know, I half expected when Schumacher later came into the pits that, you know, Ross Brawn would come up and smack him on the helmet. Yeah, like, come on,
very,
Michael.
It was very parental sounding. Yeah. Absolutely.
So after that second message, when Ross Brawn said, okay, leave lots of room, Michael's like, all right, I'll show you what leaving a lot of room does. And of course, he left enough room and Hamilton was able to make his way through. By.
Yeah. And after the first round of his pit stops, you know, Hamilton actually ended up behind Schumacher again, but the way they ended up being a little bit out of sync there, and, you know, Hamilton did eventually, you know, get ahead of Schumacher permanently. He did end up finishing fourth, so that is a finish for Lewis. That is good. That's 12 points. That helps him out. Schumacher, though, finishing fifth, that's the second time in a row he's finished fifth. He finished fifth at Spa as well, and a great, great showing. It is a little bit difficult. It'd be nice to see where Nico would have ended up had he been still in the race, but I think a very strong performance for Schumacher two races in, and I don't have it in front of me. You might, Jim. In the championship, you know, Schumacher is much, much closer to Rosberg this year and showing some good form. And the Mercedes in general has starting to show a little bit more pace, or maybe the bigger tracks suit the car a little bit better. I don't know. But definitely some stronger performances from the Mercedes, and it has pushed Mercedes a little bit more solidly ahead of Renault. And they're kind of a little bit more firmly in the fourth place in the Constructors' Championship. And it's great to see Schumacher quick again, because he is, just some of his racecraft is pretty darn impressive.
Yeah, well, to be able to hold off a car behind him just on the edge of legality, where they can't penalize him because he's not really blocking. He's using, you know, there are times to going through a chicane where you have to go left and you have to go right to make your driving line, you know, to get around the track. And if he happens to make those maneuvers at times when it's inconvenient for the guy behind him, he's just driving his race. He's not blocking, but right. He's defensively, you know, just, you know, being on that line.
And that's not easy to do.
Knowing when to push and when not to. I mean, Schumacher still doesn't have quite as many points as Rosberg. He's got 52 points to Rosberg's 56.
But compare that to last year.
Yeah. When it was, a very, very one-sided story. Right. So they're seventh and eighth in the championship. Not brilliant, but they are, I guess, best of the non Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, right. Six. They are 7-8.
They are the best of the non-race winners, is a reasonable way to put it. In sixth was Felipe Massa, who was also the last guy on the lead lap. Now, that might beg the question, it did does me at the moment at least, where did Weber end up finishing?
Oh, boy. In a wall.
In a wall. He officially is ranked, I think it's 20th. Weber did not do so well this weekend.
Yeah, so he had a coming together with Massa, which, where do you come down on that?
Racing incident, I lean against Weber just a little bit. I don't think Weber gave Massa quite enough room, and that's why he ended up clanging against Massa's wheel a little bit.
Yeah, so what happened? They came together, and it was enough to dislodge Weber's front wing and ended up sort of sticking underneath his car. He was kind of dragging it along.
Right.
And it did spin Massa around, so it moved him from 8th or wherever he was down to like 14th. It was
it was 6th to 11th or something like that.
Bad for him as well. And but then, yeah, so you know, halfway around the lap for Weber, he goes to slow down for the final corner and come into the pits and get a wing and just gets on the brakes and there's just nothing. He just locks it up. He says he lost steering because the car was dragging the front wing. And
that's not why he lost steering. So 2 points. All right, first.
And well, he ended up in the wall and retired.
Yep, sorry, okay. So first, the incident against Massa, I'd say it's a little bit on Weber, but it was basically a racing incident. It's very tight down there. You're going from like 210 miles an hour to 50 miles an hour. It's a huge brake zone, very tight chicane. It's very easy to get that wrong. People come together, it happens. But once that happens, and your front wing is underneath the car, not in front where it's supposed to be, slow down. The thing that I could not believe is how late Weber was trying to brake for, I think it was the Parabolica, and of course he's going to lock up, and of course he's not going to have steering, because you've just lost several hundred pounds of downforce. You're not going to be able to brake nearly as late. And so it was just...
He doesn't know that, though. I mean,
he does know that. There's no front wing there.
You can't see a front wing from the cockpit.
You're telling me his team didn't... Well, first of all, he had to know it was damaged.
Yes, he knew. He said he knew there was damage, but he didn't know the extent of it.
The team... There's no way the team... I don't know. Okay, maybe I'm just being a jerk, but...
It's Weber. They don't tell him anything.
Australia is a lovely country.
They were busy
telling... Australia is beautiful. They have beautiful beaches.
I don't get where you're going with that.
Great food. I like Australia.
No, it's Red Bull and it's Weber. So they were busy telling Vettel like how amazing he was and like Weber.
See. And the way you do your hair, it's so good.
And they were like, well, this will you know save any team orders problems coming up later on. Let's just let Weber crash into the wall over there. I don't know. So he didn't know.
Okay, if he really didn't know that his front wing wasn't attached anymore, fine. But
it seems like you could also just err on the side of caution and say, I'm not sure how messed up my wing is, but I'm going to go ahead and start braking here instead of giving it another, you know, couple hundred feet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that could have happened, and it didn't, and he was sad. He got out of the car, kind of tossed the steering wheel off, and had to, you know, that ended his day.
It certainly did, and it moved him back in the... Oh, no. Did it? Yeah. Moved him back in the championship. Weber was second. I believe he's now fourth behind Jenson Button, who's in third. Alonso's now second in the championship. So not a great showing for Weber. That is not the type of thing you want to do if you want to prove to the team that you can also contend for championships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happened.
So going down the list, we're now into lap traffic, but there are still some very impressive results here. Jaime Alguersuari, who had pretty bad qualifying, he ended up being out in Q3. It was him and the three new teams. Finished seventh, collecting 6 points. Very strong result for him. Paul Di Resta, eighth for Force India. Bruno Senna collecting his first championship points ever.
Yep.
In a Formula One car.
And good job. I mean, he had promising qualifying last weekend, and of course that didn't end well for him, and wants to, was basically expecting, my goal is to get some points this weekend, and he got some points this weekend. Of course, it was helped by the fact that several cars that were ahead of him were taken off track, but he also did have to go and take a pit and, you know, pit stop and get a new wing and all that, so I think it was on his own merits, you know, getting a couple championship points. Also, Daniel Ricciardo in the HRT HRT. He did out-qualify his teammate Liuzzi, which was his goal, by about, I think it was 0.177 seconds, so not by a huge amount, but it's faster, and was in the garage for a while and ended up being like 11 laps down or something. It was
14, it says, ooh, actually, at the end of the day.
So technically, I guess, not classified as a finish, but it was, you know, they did get the car back out, and...
I guess it was basically like, this is a good seat time opportunity for mm-hmm. the young driver, good test session, let's just... go out and learn something.
Get some laps and make the sponsors happy and so on. So, yeah, he was running at the end of the race, although I guess the classification maybe not, you know, he's
well, it says position NC, not classified, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was, you know, just kind of involved in the craziness at the lower half of the field. You know, Pastor Maldonado made some good moves and whatever, but, you know, didn't end up capitalizing very well. He was out of the points, and Barrichello was sort of another casualty of the whole going, you know, mm-hmm. nonsense at the beginning. So
yep,
some of their mid-pack results there.
So there it be. Monza, baby.
Vettel, man. Ugh. It's just, I mean, it's not quite to the point where it's boring when he wins, but it's like...
I don't think so at all. For me, the Schumacher thing got boring when it was like the third time round that he was super dominant.
Year five, yeah.
This is the first year where Vettel is being super dominant. I mean, remember last year this time, the Red Bull was very fast, but Weber was in the lead at the time, and the championship was very close. Alonso still looked very strong. In fact, going into the last race, we were very possibly looking at an Alonso championship. Mm-hmm. So...
Or Lewis Hamilton going into the second to last race, and then yeah, it was wide open, and of course, as we remember, Vettel was never in the lead of the championship until the very end when it mattered. So was yeah, certainly not dominant, but looking back, you know, obviously that was his championship, and then you know here he is dominating now. But
in my mind, what we're really seeing is just the coming of a racing driver that's incredibly quick and just becoming more complete. As he goes, he's just showing the grit that you need to do these things, and he's in the fastest car, clearly.
Yeah.
But he's also – Weber is not a slow guy, but Weber, like you said, the team isn't behind him like they are behind Vettel, and he doesn't maybe quite have quite the speed that Vettel has. But clearly, it's not just the car.
Yeah.
Vettel is also – getting the absolute maximum out of this car.
You're saying he's better than Jacques Villeneuve here.
I'm saying he is just a little bit better than Jacques Villeneuve.
Okay, just to be clear on that.
That is a great insight. That's why people listen to us. Sebastian Vettel,
better
than Villeneuve.
Than Jacques Villeneuve. Oh, man. Okay, well, wow. I think we've got quite a bit to talk about for the fans this week, so let's do some feedback.
Once again, and always, our favorite part of the show, it's listener feedback time. And we had a few comments on the Facebook page, on the F1 show page itself. We had tons of feedback on Facebook. But really, one listener kind of dominated this whole show, this whole essence around Monza. And that was none other than CKW. And... so I'll just start right now by saying huge, massive props. We appreciate it from the bottom of our hearts, and we love you for it. And it's so great to have you contribute the way you have. So we're hugely appreciated. But I also want to give a shout out to everyone that commented on the Facebook page itself, which wasn't just CKW. It was also Jono and also Bellissimo. Craig also said he asked us a question, and I want to answer this question. On Facebook, it was asked if your wives will ever have a guest appearance on the podcast.
That's probably a negatory
that's
good
a
buddy.
Bad idea.
Yeah. Not that they wouldn't have insightful, you know, commentary and interesting points to add.
Mine wouldn't. At all. I mean, see, here's the thing. Our podcast has very little to do with tennis ever.
Yeah.
So she's not going
to
be very...
If it were a tennis podcast, she would be a great asset to the team.
A much bigger asset than I would be. Absolutely. And if this happened to be something about Nadal, mm-hmm. I think his name is...
Rafael
Nadal.
I think.
Yeah. Then it would be a very different story. Roger Federer.
Which tells you how good of a tennis podcast we could do. That's the one.
There's this one guy.
They have the bat in that game, I think.
Yeah. It's the bat with the wickets.
Ah.
The wicket bat. Mm. And you know what the funny thing is? They use the balls you use to play catch with dogs with.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would do that.
Maybe it started out as a dog game. Not sure.
And this is why we don't have our wives listen all the time either.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's a negative. But also on the Facebook page, lots and lots of activity, lots of conversation. It was all very good. Neil Popham, always in there, having great insights. He's been doing a lot of work keeping the prediction app up to date in terms of the racing, but also up to date in terms of what Facebook demands. So I definitely want to give a shout out to him. That's hugely appreciated. I mean, it's almost something we take for granted now, and I want to make sure that that's not the case. This is something that takes active work from him, and we appreciate it. We personally use it, and allowing everyone else to use it, I think it's great. And we had a lot of good comments. Tim Plath, Deb Miller, Sean Scanlon, always there, always active.
Yeah, I want to mention James Payne, just as a quick note. Dear McLaren, Ferrari, Mercedes, etc., work harder. Sincerely, every F1 fan in the world.
Yes.
Or the Scanlon corollary to the Payne doctrine. Dear Red Bull, slow down.
Two sides of the same coin, I think. And either way would work for us. Jaffa Graves was also active. And I hadn't seen him in a little while. But somehow we now have a F1 show banner. Mm-hmm. And I'm using air quotes for those who can't see what I'm doing here, because it's not exactly how I would picture a banner, but it is way more of a banner than we ever had before.
True.
So it's certainly credit for that. But what's more impressive, you have to go to the Facebook page, and because everyone's been so active, you actually have to kind of click down to the older posts. CKW is all over the place with that banner, and I have to point this out because I thought it was so fantastic. Craig, CKW... Damn it. CKW wears a kilt to the races, and there's a pouch thing that is like part of the kilt dress.
Yeah, part of the...
That's right in the center of everything, right? And he's got an F1 show sticker right there, which is awesome. And I said, oh, that's cool that that's part of your kilt. And he said, no, the F1 show sticker is on what's called a sporran. And I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. But so it's right there, boom, right in front and center. But so now we've got all these pictures of Craig with the F1 show sticker on the sporran and the F1 show banner with all these various people, and includes some people from the BBC and this other stuff. So
it looks like signed by Lee McKenzie, the lovely, also Scottish, BBC correspondent for that. And apparently a sign with Ted from BBC, who's giving us a frowny face. And of course, CKW is proudly holding the F1 show banner. So it's great stuff from CKW, who has pretty solidly put himself as number one F1 show ambassador to the world.
Yes,
I think.
Absolutely. So just a lot of fun. We hugely appreciate it. It's funny. So my wife actually, she's the one that designed that logo that is now being displayed on various kilt parts and
sporran, if you will.
on sporran,
multi-sporri.
So that's certainly appreciated. And to just kind of see this little thing that we created that we do in, Jim's basement as often as we do it anywhere else, have this funny worldwide connection is just so much fun.
It's pretty great. It's very gratifying. And as we always say with listener feedback, it's a chance to hear from our listeners. And in most cases, of course, you still hear from us reading what our listeners have written. But in this case, CKW went out on a mission to actually allow all of you, our listeners, to be able to hear from some other F1 show fans. So let's check out what he came up with.
Do you listen to the F1 show at all?
I don't speak English.
No? Okay. Do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
No, I wish I did. But
you should do it. Really good. Do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
No, sorry about it, no.
Oh, it's excellent. No. It's very good. It's two American guys that know what they're talking about when it comes to F1.
Formula One.
It's very unusual. Do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
Yes, I'm made to listen to it.
Yeah. Do you think it's very good?
Yes, it's very good.
And are the presenters sexy, sexy men?
They sound it.
Okay, there we go. We'll ask somebody else. Do you listen to the F1 show podcast at all?
Yes, he does. My son does.
Well, do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
Yes, that's right.
You
do? Yes.
Oh, you guys say hello. This is going to be on it. Say hello. Say your name.
Cameron Gunn.
Craig the Kilt Wilson, and they can't say Craig correctly.
Can they not say Craig?
They go Craig.
Craig.
Drive you mental.
It does, aye. But no.
I can't believe we've found someone.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. Of course we watch it.
Excellent. Good stuff. Do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
No.
You don't? You should listen to it.
Okay, I will do. Thank you.
Do you listen to the F1 show podcast?
I haven't today.
You should. It's two Americans that love F1.
Okay, no problem. We'll give it a listen.
Good. You'll enjoy it. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Another convert. I'm doubling your listenership here.
So Sebastian Vettel has made the predictions part of our show a little bit less, all too predictable, I guess, right? A little less exciting, because there's always the option of the safe bet and figuring, okay, Sebastian Vettel's going to be on pole.
There is not the option of the safe bet. There is correct and incorrect. You have to remember that if he wins, he wins. That's it. That's how it goes. The safe bet would be to not predict. We are not safe because we predict weeks in advance without knowing anything. What if Vettel was struck by lightning between now and Singapore? We'd be hosed if we picked Vettel. That's not safe.
Yeah, fair enough. So let's see how...
I just blew your mind.
You
I
did.
I can see it.
You
can see it dribbling out your ear.
No, that's mellow yellow. No. So first of all, let's see. We did predict from... you know, 2 weekends ago,
yes.
What the results of Monza would be. And we were wrong, but let's see how close to wrong.
Credit where credit is due, sir. You
took the daring step.
You correctly predicted Vettel on pole, and I thought that was a mistake. I said it over and over and over again. This is the one place where Red Bull is not going to be strong. I was wrong.
Yeah.
Now, you fell a little bit short of absolute clairvoyance when you said, no, I do agree with you that Alonso is going to win the race.
Well, except that I predicted first, so I think I think you were trying to copy me with your whole Alonso nonsense. I don't think you can take credit for that.
I totally came up with it in my head before you came out with it in your head. The fact that you happened to say it first, irrelevant.
Means nothing.
And erroneous that you think you came up with it first. Anyway, you said Vettel was going to be on pole and Alonso was going to win the race. Vettel indeed was on pole, but Alonso, hence, could only finish third. 2 points for you. However, I said, no, 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 this is Ferrari's hometown, home turf, and it's certainly not going to be Massa. I said Alonso will be on pole and win the race. Alonso was fourth in qualifying, and as I just said, third in the race. So I ended up with 5 points. Hats off to you. Coke to you, sir. And the statistical model, or heuristical model, if you want to be technical about it, said... whoever won the race last time is going to win the race again. Whoever was on pole last time is going to be on pole again. I said that backwards, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And indeed, it was absolutely correct. Vettel, Vettel. That's what it was. No points for the statistical model. It is still at a dead, blood-draining 26 points.
So it has only predicted incorrectly by 26 positions, and that's total of from pole position and from race winning.
This whole season.
This whole season, which is... you know, there are 24 cars in the field. So, like, one in one race, if you get, you know, if I were to predict Hamilton and he ends up retiring first, I could get 24 points just from that.
Which and yet, you've done once effectively, and yeah. I've done once effectively.
And
yeah.
And yet, the stat model.
And I think it was Hamilton both times.
And yet, the stat model, you know, has only 26 points for the entire season thus far for a combination of poles and wins. And that is partly due to, of course, Vettel's ridiculous streak of performance, and that when he doesn't come on pole, that second place. You know?
Yeah, I think his worst finishing position is fourth. Is that right? I think it is.
I think so.
So we are, however, statistical model aside, you and I are actually doing pretty well.
Right.
James Payne is holding it down.
Yeah, so the stat model has 26 points. James Payne has got 45, so he's in second place. You, Robin, are in third with 55 points, actually tied with Bodhi Tuladar, who also has 55 points. Then it's me with 58 points in fifth. And then Sean Scanlon, Ben Hessenthaler, Craig Wilson.
CKW.
Ken Frischknecht and Neil Popham running up the top 10 and going down to as much as 90 points, which tells you there's lots of people that have predicted that have been, you know, I think some hopeful predictions of like, Weber. And I'm sure anyone who predicted Weber certainly got hosed this
Weber's
past weekend.
The Weber prediction has been a much tougher go this time around. So
yeah. And that's always the problem though, right? Is do you want to just go with something sort of like, it's probably likely to happen, or maybe a little more risky, a little more interesting, and say, well, you know, cause Hamilton of course has had some victories and, you know, is never that far away, but then sometimes he, you know, balls it up and is very far away. So
I did you a favor.
Yeah.
And for Singapore, I know what you're going to say, so I've already done it. Senna.
Daniel Ricciardo.
Yeah. No, Senna.
Oh,
for you.
The safe bet.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And for me, I am going to go out on a limb here. And so here's the thing. This is what we're talking about, right? There's the safe bet. If it's correct and if it's also what you think is going to happen, that's what you should predict.
Right.
And what I think is going to happen seeing that we've seen, the performance that we've seen at Spa and Monza, I cannot deny Sebastian Vettel. Is it eventually not going to go his way? Yes. But you
maybe
definitely,
maybe not, though. Jeez.
You definitely can't predict that. So I think Vettel's going to be on pole, and I think Vettel is going to win the race. That's what I think. I even predicted first between the two of us.
Yeah, well, except I did actually. Now, has yours been entered into the Facebook app? Because mine already has. So I think that means, regardless of what you're speaking, that my prediction actually did come in first.
I still consider my little Excel spreadsheet the master list between the two of us, and I have hence put it there.
Well,
first.
There's no proof, though, anywhere except your computer, which, of course, isn't really evidence that you did that first.
It is also on one of my Time Machine hard drives, sir. But maybe not this part. What do you want to put? Just tell me. Jeez.
Well, there's this young German who's just doing really well this year, and I think he's going to continue to do really well.
Schumacher. Got it.
No, young German.
Oh, young at heart, I thought you meant.
No. Young at life.
Ralph,
I mean, dude,
Schumacher?
It's dude. I mean, Sebastian Vettel is just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lame because now all of us will have the same fate. There's no benefit.
Yeah.
To pulling ahead of
we
you
are
or the statistical
in position
model
here, but at the
so
same time,
if James Payne is predicting something different, and Vettel crashes out or something, which of course is possible,
yes,
then he may come up and dominate against us and the statistical model. But probably what will happen is that Sebastian Vettel will do well.
Here's the thing, right? At this point in time, if anything does happen to Vettel, we're now all going to be hosed. We're gonna suffer those consequences that we've been talking about the statistical model suffering this whole time.
Yeah.
So,
I was thinking about putting Alonso for the win, but since Nelson Piquet is not going to be in Singapore this year, I just don't think that's as safe of a bet.
You know, the most tempting guy for me is Button. I'm telling you, Button, these Spa and Monza.
You should put that.
When he's not punted in the side pod, is really fucking quick.
Yeah.
Really, really silly quick.
It's very quick.
And
blew your own mind there.
I just think if I were to put anybody, I'd put Button.
Then put Button.
He's just switched on right now. But he would be my prediction for second.
Oh, but since we're not predicting for second,
you're going to
stick with
that. Exactly. That's how it is. So, yeah, I guess in kind of the anticlimactic way of Q3 for Monza, that's the way the show is going to end a little bit.
We have qualified, as it were.
But before we go entirely, I have to say that you, sir, sorry, don't look great naked, but you do look wonderful.
Where are you going?
Fantastic with
this?
With an F1 show shirt on.
Ah.
And you don't have to be the only one that looks fantastic, because all of our listeners, in fact, everyone in the world, can go to warnermotorsports.com and pick up an F1 show shirt or F1 show stickers or some other shirts that are also fabulous that are related to cars and racing and just part of this community.
Which, as we heard, are great conversation pieces, especially at F1 events.
Absolutely. CKW is a proud owner of such things and puts them in various places that are wonderful for all of us. And please, it's kind of a way to help fund our little effort here if you want to think of it that way. I hope that it's also just nice apparel to wear. So, yeah, if you get a chance, go to warnermotorsports.com and take a look.
And as we've talked about, these shirts are race-proven on several continents now.
Yes.
In Europe and North America. I jumped out of a plane wearing an F1 show shirt one time.
So fantastic of you to do so.
Performed admirably. And I visited the F1 track in Austin before it was even done yet. With an F1 show t-shirt, and it held up for that as well.
Yes,
so absolutely. It's really, I mean, it's an incredible, incredible piece of clothing.
I'm wearing mine right now, and I drank an entire can of Mellow Yellow, and it's not torn to shreds.
Yeah.
That's durability.
It sure is. And so basically we've got 2 weeks. We've got a week off and then Singapore. And this is, up until now, we had the summer break and all that. But now it's starting to seem like it's coming to the end of the season, but we've still got Brazil at the very end, Abu Dhabi, India, if the circuit all comes together, Korea, Japan, and then, Singapore in 2 weeks. There's still plenty that can go on. I feel like we're kind of in the home stretch. Like, it's kind of this,
And the reason why you feel that way is because Vettel could clinch next race.
Yeah. But, we've got plenty of F1 left this year. And, just because it's getting late in the, it's becoming fall, doesn't mean that we don't have two more months of solid racing. I mean, it's... After Thanksgiving is the finale in Brazil, November 27th. So this we are Wow, you got a ways to go.
That's
but
this year, I thought that was next year that it was going until after Thanksgiving. That's
no, this year as well.
Wow.
Yep.
My goodness.
Yep. So, yeah, until then, please feel free to visit f1show.com to take part in comments on our page right there. You can visit Facebook. You can visit Twitter. You can see all the lovely, the photos and everything that the CKW and others have posted. And you can visit WarnerMotorsports.com from there. So until you hear from us in 2 weeks' time after the Singapore Grand Prix show, thank you, as always, for listening. I am Jim Lau.
And I'm Robin Warner, reminding you to always eat your vegetables and listen to the F1 show. See ya.